On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm John Hockenberry, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. 44 million American workers are enrolled in a company-defined pension plan. But how much do they know about their corporate nest egg? You may know that some high-profile companies underfunded their plans and left surprised retirees with nothing but resentment and paltry Social Security to fund their golden years. On top of job insecurity, now there's pension insecurity to consider. It's a national crisis, and last week, President Bush signed sweeping pension reform legislation. We're going to dig in for a closer look at the benefits and costs. This hour, On Point, milestone pension legislation. Have we dodged a bullet? Or does it signal the end of the pension system as we know it? We begin with a closer look at the bill and what it took to pull it off. Teo Francis is a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He joins me now from Tampa, Florida. Good day, Teo.
Hi, how are you?
You're kind of in the pensioner theme park down there in Florida, right?
Very much so, yes. A lot of retirees around here.
So tell us about the bill and what it accomplished and how it was accomplished. It's really kind of extraordinary that this Congress pulled off something so big.
Well, what it accomplished, of course, ultimately remains to be seen, and much of the proof will be in how it turns out over the next several years. The emphasis in the bill and the emphasis of a lot of the coverage has been on the funding provisions, the provisions that were really touted as making pensions safer and better funded so that the money would be there when retirees needed it. There's some questions that have been raised about how well it's going to do that. Two government reports have raised some serious questions. The PBGC, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is a quasi-private government insurer that insures defined benefit pension plans. The PBGC came out with a report in June saying that the compromises that were under consideration then would actually leave the agency with about $2 billion more in claims than current law, or than, you know, what was then the current law, and would actually leave plans about $10 to $30 billion less well-funded. Since then, the Congressional Budget Office has come out with a report that came to somewhat similar conclusions. There's also special provisions in there for airlines, which are some of the ones that have, as you said in the intro, have really abandoned their pensions and left some retirees or some workers with lower and smaller pensions than they had been promised.
So the three parts of this bill, essentially, and if there's probably 20 more that I'm not mentioning, but it forces companies to better fund their existing pensions, doesn't allow them to get behind as they have been. It makes it easier for, and in fact creates a whole system for dumping workers who aren't enrolled in pensions into 401k programs, and I don't say dumping with any sort of pejorative idea there. And then finally, it makes these exceptions for certain industries that have traditional problems as a way of helping the Federal Guarantee Agency become solvent.
Right. Well, and there's a lot more to it. I mean, it is a 1,000-page bill, or almost 1,000 pages. There's a lot in there that has not gotten a lot of attention, and hopefully I'll be able to talk a little bit about some of that. But those are the main points, and those are certainly the points that have received the most attention. Again, there's been some questions raised about how well it'll do in terms of shoring up pension finance. It's just because some of the technical intricacies of the bill. The politics, as you mentioned, has been interesting as well, or rather the process. There were two competing bills, one in the Senate and the House, as often happens. There was a conference committee to try to reconcile those. That conference committee kept stalling, and essentially just before the House took off for the summer, as they customarily do, they did an end run around the conference committee, essentially passing a version of the compromise that was then under negotiation but had stalled, and basically daring the Senate either to pass it themselves or to take the risk that there would be no pension bill this year.
It sounds like someone in Congress is perceiving that there is some momentum out there, that this is, in certain quarters of the United States, perceived as a crisis, that people are really worried about their pensions, and Congress doesn't want to be in a position of not having done anything, and here we are in the middle of another savings and loan crisis.
Well, certainly there's definitely the perception of a crisis in a lot of quarters. You know, a lot of retirees have heard about some of the airlines and steel companies abandoning their pensions to the federal insurer. More people have probably heard about companies like IBM freezing their pension plans, even though the pensions were actually quite well funded. And so, you know, a lot of companies have been not exactly abandoning the plans, but freezing them, meaning that, that nobody was going to earn any new benefits going forward. So you do have those. Retiree advocates have some concerns about the bill as well that go beyond sort of the funding mechanisms. There's some provisions in there that really do kind of break new ground. One of them is that they make it much easier for companies to convert to cash balance plans. These are a fairly controversial form of defined benefit pension that when companies have converted in the past, it's often led to smaller pensions for older workers in particular, although a government report that came out recently said that, that all employees actually tend to do worse off under these cash balance plans. The law and the law basically paves the way for more companies to convert, and prior court decision actually that coincidentally came around the same time as the law was passed by both houses, a court decision also seems to have eased the threat to companies that have already converted. So cash balance plans are likely to be more of a trend in the future. There's been some interesting studies that show that companies most likely to convert to cash balance plans are those with older workers.
Interesting. So certainly this bill suggests a whole range of changes afoot that people need to pay attention to. And, you know, we've already documented a little bit that Americans are not known for paying a lot of attention to their savings and pensions. And now vigilance is certainly in order. Tao Francis, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, Tao Francis, spoke with me from Tampa, Florida. We're talking this hour about sweeping pension reform and what it means for your retirement. Come on, be honest. Are you a disciplined or undisciplined saver? Are you on the verge of bankruptcy? Do you have a 401k plan? Tell us about your experience, your anxiety. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from South Bend, Indiana, is Teresa Ghilarducci. She's a professor of economics and director of the Higgins Labor Research Center at the University of Notre Dame, and is a member of the General Accounting Office Retirement Advisory Panel. Her forthcoming book is The End of Retirement. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And with me in the studio is Zvi Bodie, professor of finance and economics at Boston University School of Management. He's author of Worry-Free Investing, A Safe Approach to Achieving Your Lifetime Financial Goals. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Teresa, let me begin with you. What do we make of this bill? And if I have a balance in my pension, what should I be thinking about it right now?
Well, it depends upon what kind of pension you have, John, because Congress acted as if they had two children, traditional plans and 401k plans, and they viewed one child as bad and the other one needed to be coddled. So if you have a traditional pension plan, you should be concerned that your company will probably freeze that plan. You'd be lucky if they transferred that plan transform that plan into a cash balance plan. But myself and many others think that Congress made employers who sponsor these plans actually more unsure about what the rules are going to be, and the funding looks like it might be more erratic, and gave them all the incentive in the world to cut back on those plans, which is really too bad.
Well, that's actually terrifying. I mean, because, you know, I'm a person who can't hold a job. I actually have a 401k from one employer, an old pension from another employer, a union pension that's a defined benefit plan, and, you know, any number of little accounts here and there. It sounds like the pension, the defined pension component of my retirement, is the one most under threat from this bill.
Oh, no. If it's from a past employer, that's set in stone by a law that they didn't transform ERISA. That's guaranteed.
What about unions?
Your union plan is probably the most promising one.
Oh, yeah.
That union plan is alive. That if that plan has money in it, it actually may give you a cost of living increase. There actually should be more of those kinds of plans, and we can talk about that.
Yeah, actually, I'd just like you to call me every day if you're going to deliver news like that, Professor. Thank you very much. Zvi, Professor Bodie, what do you make of this bill. It seems to me that one of the problems and the reasons for this legislation was an issue of somebody's holding a lot of obligations and they're not paying into it. Has that situation changed? Have we balanced the books?
Well, my perspective is that this Pension Protection Act is pretty much much ado about nothing. It hasn't really addressed what I consider to be the most important issue for the defined benefit system, which is kind of disappearing, as I think will become more and more clear during this broadcast, and the new system, which is taking its place, which is built around 401k type company-sponsored plans and IRA type of individual pension arrangements.
Professor Ghilarducci, you know, there's a cultural question implicit in this new bill, and that is we've had a situation where Americans have been encouraged to think that pensions are something that happen invisibly out of their oversight, and it's taken care of either by an employer or a union or Social Security or something like that. Now we're shifting to something where people have to be much more vigilant about what's going on. Is that a bad thing? Have we suffered from this assumption of invisibility in the pension system? And does this bill do anything to help us?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think that people knew that they had a defined benefit plan when they had one, especially if you're over 35. There's a switch seems to flip. And I think most people know that they probably give up a little bit of wages in order to get that security. They feel that same way about health insurance as well. If shifting to a 401k plan makes people more aware of their accounts, well, awareness is a good thing. But as Zeev said, they're not equipped to handle that awareness or do much about it. Probably 99.9% of us, and I include myself, aren't good investors, and I'm a professor of economics. Also, many people who have these individual accounts will lose their jobs or switch jobs. It sounds like you did. And
Don't bring that up, will you?
You're in a dynamic industry, and you have lots of skills, and you go from employer to employer, the ones that really appreciate you.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
okay. Tell that to my wife.
But what's just amazing is that people cash out of these 401k plans when they do switch jobs, even though they pay a 10% penalty, which means these 401k plans are really a kind of a national severance plan or layoff plan. And even though people know that they should always contribute, now it's going to be maybe 7 to 20% every single month and not touch it and follow the best advice they can pay for. They won't, mainly because we're human beings and humans just can't do it.
But I thought, you know, you turn on all these business stations and everybody talks about how if you invest money in the stock market over 40 years, you're going to – it's a no-brainer. You're going to be fine. It's going to go up. Zvi, I mean, what's wrong with that idea? And talk about this curious provision in the bill that allows mutual fund companies to actually give advice and sell information to 401k recipients for the first time.
Right. Well, first of all, let me say, as a finance professor, I know I'm not certified to talk on behalf of all finance professors. But frankly, I don't know a single person who teaches investments for a living that believes in the statement that you open with, that if you're investing for 40 years, there's nothing in the stock market, there's nothing to worry about. In fact, quite the contrary. If there were nothing to worry about, then why don't mutual funds offer insurance for free? Has any mutual fund said to you, put your money in my stock market fund? I guarantee you that at the end of 40 years, you will at least get back what you put in adjusted for inflation.
I have not heard that.
Okay. Then maybe suppose someone sold you some other product and said, I guarantee you this is great. And you say, will you give me that guarantee in writing? And, you know, will it be a genuine guarantee? And they say, oh, no, we can't do that. Wouldn't that make you a little suspicious?
Well, but let's talk about the Japanese for a moment. I mean, here's a country that is full of profligate savers. I mean, they save like crazy. And I'm wondering if people in Japan are more secure because they're very interested in savings. They monitor their investments. And, okay, maybe there are ups and downs in the Japanese stock market, but they're probably in a better position than most Americans.
Well, funny you should mention Japan, because that's the example that I usually give to point out the downside risk of the stock of stocks, even in the long run. Consider this. In 1988, if you can remember that far back, if I had asked you what economy in the world is likely to do best over the next 20 years, what would your answer have been? This is 1988.
I don't know. It would probably have been something like the Canary Islands or something.
Well,
I
mean, that maybe. But most analysts were saying Japan. The Japanese were whipping us in every area.
And they went into a decade-long recession.
Not only did they go into a decade-long recession, but in 1989, their stock market peaked. And it has still not come back to even half the level it was. In 1989.
Beware of the bubbles. I'm talking with Zvi Bodhi, professor of finance and economics at Boston University, and Teresa Ghilarducci, professor of economics at Notre Dame. Let's take a call. Cindy from Boston, Massachusetts. Do you have a question for Teresa or Zvi?
Well, I have a generalized question and sort of a statement. And my question is this. Sweeping reform, to me, hasn't been nearly sweeping enough because, to me, we're functioning on a retirement theory that people, have the same job, since they're 18 instead of switching jobs every 3 years, which you guys have sort of mentioned. But also, we don't die at 66 years old anymore. So we retire at 65, and we're expected to afford ourselves for the next potentially 30 years. And, you live in Boston, I don't know who could possibly save enough to live without working for 30 years. And should we be looking at retirement, not so much, about guaranteeing plans and things like that, but should we be looking at retirement completely in a different way?
Teresa, does the bill reflect any of those demographic issues that certainly have changed the way we look at retirement that Cindy is talking about?
Only implicitly. It makes it unlikely that people will have a secure pension. It doesn't help the people who don't have a pension. Most workers don't. And so implicitly, it does revision retirement as a period of a lot more work. And we're already there. I have to say that it's actually the Japanese that don't have much of a promise of retirement. Many more of their 65-year-olds work than do Americans. Now, that's not so bad if people want to continue work, but it is bad if you have to go to work for any job that will take you because you don't have enough retirement income. That's a reversal of progress that we made since the Great Depression.
And it's bad if you've invested in golf equipment, anticipating the baby boomers getting out on the links instead of working at Walmart. Kevin from Randolph, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm 50 years old, and until about the age of 36, I knew nothing about investing money, and I learned at that point that I have to teach myself. And I've done so over the last 14 years, and I've done extremely well. Contrary to what a lot of people I hear, experts on talk shows, who try to tell me that the average person can't do this, usually that's correct, but that's only because they don't know how. But there's not a reason in the world that people can't teach themselves how. There's not enough education in this country in investing. There never has been, as evidenced by the fact that I was 36 years old and didn't know what I was doing. If it's going to be incumbent upon individuals to take responsibility for their own retirement, we're going to have to start teaching people in junior high at the latest about investing and money and compound interest and all of the things that go into it. But the idea that 99% of people don't know how to do it, it doesn't mean they can't.
Well, Kevin, congratulations on your success, first of all, and it sounds like you've been a reasonably quick study. But could I ask you a slightly personal question?
Sure.
How have you done in the last 4 years?
In the last 4 years, I've done very well.
Really?
I've done very well. I would say my portfolio in the last 4 years has probably I tally it on December 31st every year for the money that was in at the beginning of the year, and I probably averaged about 9% a year for the past 4 years. It's not difficult. I'm not a wild investor. I'm widely diversified. I'm fairly conservative. I'm in growth and value and bonds. And people learn to be nuclear physicists and people learn to be heart surgeons, but people are constantly trying to claim that we can't learn about money. You have to go to see an expert. You have to pay somebody to handle your money. Well, if some 18-year-old kid is eventually going to be a heart surgeon someday, he learned something, and I don't know why he can learn that, but he can't learn about handling money.
All right, Kevin, good point. Teresa, what do you think? Is Kevin's success duplicatable, or is it a one-off?
I think, 1% of the population will learn, will pay attention. More people should know that if they go into debt and pay interest, they'll just become more in debt. I'm not so worried. I know Ziv is, but I'm not so worried about actually the investment expertise. I'm really concerned that humans can't discipline themselves and voluntarily save a certain amount of money every year. And if people are going to switch jobs, the temptation to take some of that money out is very high. Then you compound it with the needs of children to go to school. That's especially important for women's accumulations and all the other things that come between you and age 65. So I'm worried about the accumulation and the leakages from those accumulations.
All right. I'm speaking with Teresa Ghilarducci from Notre Dame and Zvi Bodhi here at Boston University. Joining me now, and I want to hold on to both of those thoughts there and the callers, to bring in Edward Ferrigno, who's joining me from Washington. He's the Vice President of Washington Affairs for the Profit-Sharing 401k Council of America. Edward, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, John. It's a pleasure.
Now, I gather that you are fairly overjoyed by this bill in the sense that it creates a whole series of incentives for people to begin 401ks.
Definitely. The bill has a lot of very good provisions. First of all, it makes a entire package of pension provisions that were going to expire in 2010 permanent. And that's important both for the plan sponsors that offer the plans who need the stability that the change in the law is going to give them, and the for retirement savers who are going to be able to permanently enjoy the many improvements made in 2001. Additionally, a large portion of the bill is devoted to measures to enhance automatic enrollment in 401k plans. And we think for a lot of workers, I did hear quite a bit of the conversation, how do we help the unsophisticated saver? Well, number one, the biggest help to the unsophisticated saver is, does their employer offer them a plan at work? If the employer offers the plan at work, they're going to partner with this saver. They're going to pre-screen the investments. They're going to provide them with investment education. They're probably going to match a significant portion of their contribution, so they're going to earn 50% in returns on their contributions right up front. The bill has several provisions that will help with automatic enrollment, which is an exciting new trend whereby an employee is hired and they are told, if we don't hear from you, we're going to automatically enroll you in a 401k type plan, and we're going to make the investment decision for you. That takes great advantage of what we like to say is we want good things to happen when people do nothing, and the bill will help that occur.
Now, is that a help to the unsophisticated, as you term it, or is that really a much bigger help to Charles Schwab, who basically gets a bunch of people automatically signed up for his accounts?
Well, there's no doubt that the Charles Schwabs of the world will benefit.
And they need help. We worry about them, right?
We worry about Charles Schwab?
Well, I was being facetious there.
Yes. No, I don't worry about them. I worry about American savers and...
Glad to hear you say that.
The financial institutions and service providers have joined in partnership with employers to make savings opportunities for low- and middle-income workers, which frankly did not exist prior to the advent of the employer-provided defined contribution system.
What do you make of the change in the law that allows mutual fund managers to actually give advice to to people with 401ks to create a system for delivering analysis, analyst advice through the employer, through the fund?
Well, a couple of points on that. First, 50% of the plans that we survey provide advice today from an independent third party, which is not a party that has assets in the plan. The important thing to remember about the change in the law is that it doesn't excuse anyone of fiduciary requirements. Number one, if a asset manager is going to provide advice, they have to behave as a fiduciary. Secondly, and I think just as important, the plan sponsor retains overall fiduciary responsibility for anyone who provides service to a plan. So for those who fear that it's Katie bar the door, I think that that's a bit of an exaggeration. And in fact, it's not clear to me, particularly in the large plan world, how many plan sponsors are going to embrace this alternative as opposed to the programs that are out there now to use companies like Financial Engines and Ibbotson and Guided Choice.
Although we should note that the idea of fiduciary responsibility that you talk about falls way short of a guarantee of returns or a if the fund should go south, there's very little recourse for the investor, right?
Being a fiduciary means that you behave prudently and act in for the exclusive benefit of the participants. It doesn't mean being right. I mean, I would like to find the person who can guarantee that they're going to be right about their investments. It means that you have to put yourself in the place of the participant and act on their behalf.
Teresa, 401ks, panacea or menace?
I think they're very, very limited. And if Congress really wanted to help out people who won't have a DB and have a 401k, why didn't they just mandate that employers put all their workers in their 401k plan rather than allow them to have automatic enrollment? I mean, employers now could have automatic enrollment. Many do, but most don't. So nothing was really stopping them for making it easy for people to go in the 401ks. In fact, they save money when they don't. Why didn't Congress ban cashing out in these big lump sums that people spend?
We're talking this hour with Teresa Ghilarducci, professor of economics and director of the Higgins Labor Research Center at the University of Notre Dame. Her forthcoming book is The End of Retirement. In the studio with me is Zvi Bode, professor of finance and economics at Boston University School of Management, author of Worry-Free Investing, A Safe Approach to Achieving Your Lifetime Financial Goals. And from Washington, Edward Ferrigno is with us, vice president of Washington Affairs for the profit-sharing 401k Council of America. Let's go to Matthew from Boston. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hello.
You're on the air, bud.
Hey, my question is, I'm a 23-year-old student. I'm finishing up college this year. And following college, how does one start with limited funds investing and being concerned for my future? I know very little about stock market. I just am wondering if there's just a book that's pretty famous or any advice on where does one begin?
Let me ask you one question, Matthew. Sure. Since you're going to college in the Boston area, are you now hopelessly in debt from paying tuition?
No, fortunately I'm not.
Well, good for you.
My parents helped me quite a lot, so I'm not in that position, but I will once I start making more money. I mean, I'm employed now. I'm a piano teacher. But once I start making enough money to save and put aside some for investing, like, I don't really know where to begin investing.
All right, well, let's get some advice. Zvi, what's your advice for Matthew aside from get an IRA?
Actually, my first piece of advice is to go out and buy my book. I'm the author of two books. One is a textbook that's used in colleges and MBA programs called Investments. So if you're very serious about learning investments, that would be a place to start. And I've written a book for the layman who just wants to understand the basics of investing, and that's called Worry-Free Investing. I would say this. What we who are professionals think is when you invest, you have to decide how much you want to be in risk-free investments, which is defined as no risk.
Like bonds. That sort
like
of thing.
U.S. Treasury inflation-protected bonds. No risk. You're guaranteed to beat inflation right now by 2.5% per year, roughly.
And the alternative being stocks. Where
and
there
the alternative
risk.
Being a diversified, unmanaged, fully diversified portfolio of global stocks, not just the U.S., but global stocks. And the cheapest way to invest in that type of portfolio is through an electronically traded fund, which is the equivalent of a mutual fund, more or less. No-load mutual fund.
Why don't you just give your books to Matthew?
But, good idea.
Good idea. All right. Teresa, go ahead.
You can say that.
Yeah. The most important thing Matthew should do is commit to not spending all of his money. The most important thing is to just refrain from consumption now until you retire. And the best investment you can do is make sure you have a job covered by Social Security. That will give you, if you... about $250,000 worth of retirement annuity. And to fill that in, you'll probably have to save, and hold on to your hat, at least 10% of your piano teaching fees every single time you have a piano lesson into an account that's only for retirement, not for a house or anything else.
So 10% off the top.
Off the top. That's the best decision you can make.
Edward Ferrigno, young people like Matthew have heard, you know, since they turned on the news that Social Security was going to be dead by the time they're in a position to collect. It seems like this bill is telling them that at the very least the pension landscape is going to be very different from their parents when they get to retirement age. What can you say as words of reassurance for people like Matthew?
Well, I certainly agree with the advice that's been provided so far, but I would definitely tell Matthew to find an employer that offers a 401k plan at work. Odds are, if you defer 6% to pay, that employer is going to contribute 3%. So you've made 50% on your return, and you're at 9%, which is very close to what Professor Ghilarducci had said. As far as the changing landscape, I think that we all tend to look in the rearview mirror with rose-colored glasses. Right now, the defined benefit system is providing pension benefits to people over age 65 to 1 in 5 people over age 65, and the median amount of income they're getting is $6,700 a year. So I don't share any doom and gloom about the transition to the defined contribution system.
All right. From Nashville, Tennessee, Todd is calling. Todd, you're on the air.
Hello. I had a concern and a question as well. My concern is with the employer contribution to plans. My current employer has a set dollar amount of $300 in this case, while my wife's employer offers her a match of up to 9% of her salary, which ends up being a substantial amount of money at the end of the year. My question is there any hope that in the near-term future the government will have set up some sort of program where employers are required to match 5% or 10% of their employee's salary if they're willing to contribute the same to the retirement plans? And I'll go off the air to get the answer.
Thank you. Teresa, I'm suspecting the answer to that question is no.
Well, Congress could have done it. That was actually that would have been a very good proposal to make these things real, you know, retirement programs. But, you know, you tell me whether or not Congress or the president's going to propose that employers are mandated to do anything.
What is the incentive as it exists now in the defined benefit sphere for a company like General Electric or Ford to offer any salary match? Why do they do it?
In those cases, they have a union that negotiated that. And the employers actually found out that's actually a good idea to guarantee their workers a retirement account. It does two things. If you want to downsize, it makes it a lot easier to transition people away from, to lay them off.
To offer them buyouts, things like that.
Yeah, to buyouts. I mean, you can't do that with 401k plans. So a lot of heads of corporations will say they're very, very grateful for their defined benefit plans because it, you know, helps them be dynamic. Also, many of us are moving into our, you know, pre-retirement years, and employers are going to find it difficult to retain skilled and, let's say, mature workers. And defined benefit plans are good ways to actually, breed employer loyalty. So there are a lot of companies that are actually adopting defined benefit plans in finance, well, not a lot, some, in finance. Small businesses have actually increased their use of defined benefit plans. Their defined benefit plans serve a very good purpose, and I'd like to see Congress helping them spread.
And certainly defined benefit plans are the plans that Congress people have, workers for the state and municipalities, police forces. So they're certainly very, very popular in the public sector, even if they're not widely growing in the private sector. Sheila from Newport, Rhode Island, you're on the air.
Hi. I've just been listening to this conversation. I'm in my 50s, and I am an inveterate saver. As a matter of fact, while I was on hold, I was making my monthly contribution into my SEP. I'm self-employed. And I have to say that I don't know whether it was since I turned 50, but I am I can't sleep at night because I don't think I'm going to have enough money in retirement. And it just kills me when I see all these other people of my age who are very close to retirement saying, oh, I'll work forever, I'll work until I drop dead, I love working. And I'm thinking to myself, I just don't see that happening. I think that that's an interesting point of view. There hasn't been too much discussion about people who are perhaps within 10 years of retirement who maybe aren't prepared, and I was curious to hear some.
Okay, Sheila, thanks for calling, Zvi.
Well, frankly, I think the bigger problem is providing health care insurance and disability insurance for people as they age. I think the people that Sheila is talking to who plan to work until they drop, they probably like their jobs. I'm in that position. I have no plans to retire, but I certainly have plans to cut back. And what if I become disabled? So I think really the way to address that is through creating insurance. Now,
so that would be insurance that would eliminate the fear that possibly Sheila has that she's going to be wiped out by some sort of external event.
And it's a much more efficient. Insuring is a much more efficient way of dealing with those risks than building up this huge nest egg and then, perhaps dying with a lot of money left over. It's somewhat inefficient.
Teresa?
That's really inefficient. Defined benefit plans, Social Security is a form of insurance. If you meet the qualifications, you get the money for the rest of your life. There have been proposals that Medicare be extended to people below the age of 65. That's an interesting proposal, and it meets the concerns of the people that Sheila knows. By the way, inveterate savers like her represent about 28% of the population. I think human beings are wired that a third worry and do something about their worries, another third worry and don't do anything else, another third are, just kind of present-minded. And survey after survey kind of shows the population divided by that. What really concerns me are the people that say, well, I'm just going to continue to work until I drop. First of all, there's evidence to show that jobs that older people have are actually getting more difficult, despite the fact you don't have to haul pig iron or do other physical things or because there's a computer. Women especially are reporting, older women, that they have jobs that require intense concentration, a lot of stress, and keen eyesight. And men are too. It's a 17% increase with jobs of those characteristics. Also, a lot of older people suffer from age discrimination, and you get dissed at work, and that loss of status can be very stressful. So I think the idea, the statement that I'm going to work when I get older is more a wish rather than a plan.
Edward Frigno, there's been some discussion about, Sheila was certainly talking about her anxiety as a saver. What's a good-sized 401k for someone in their 40s, would you say?
Well, that's a tough one. We use a rule of thumb. First of all, you should do planning, and there are numerous websites, including our website, that will help you do planning. And we suggest that you have a goal of 10 times your final pay as a savings plan, and there are numerous sites that you can get on to project that. I certainly agree with the other speakers and with Sheila that early retiree health care is a problem that's too often overlooked by people who think they're going to retire at age 60 or age 62 and aren't going to be eligible for Medicare at age 65. But there are many, many websites. I think the DOL has one. I think the SEC has one that will help you project your future savings need and what you should be saving today.
Great advice, Edward. Harry is calling from Sumter, South Carolina. Harry, you're on the air.
I'm afraid that the greatest generation, which was my parents, has raised the greediest generation, which is me. We want to spend like sailors, as you can look at our savings rate, and then expect a great retirement. And I think that dumping so many people into 401ks will be a disaster, given our penchant and our habits.
Edward, that speaks directly to you.
Yeah, well, the good news is that the data that we have shows that the 401k system is working, that the 401k system is going to generate revenue that's going to match and or exceed what the current group of retirees is getting. You do have to save. You do have to participate. No one's going to pretend that it's easy. But the system is out there. The employer is teaming with you to assist you. And many, many people are taking advantage of it.
Teresa, what do you see in the future if the behaviors of our caller are played out on a massive demographic scale?
Well, I agree with him. I think that depending upon humans and American workers to save 10% of their income, and that's probably low. I save 20. To fund their entire retirement is going to be, in his words, a disaster. My word, too. Actually, a lot of people are saying that people should have 20 to 25 times their final salary to make it through retirement because of health care costs and because they're living longer. That means a middle-class worker today would need over $1 million to fund their retirement and stay middle class.
That's $1 million in the bank.
$1 million in the bank, this big, huge nest egg, and probably a little bit more. I agree with Viv. You should take that $1 million and, you know, buy lots of insurance, you know, make it an annuity. The other problem is our savings rate. The decline in the DB system is actually correlated with a decline in our savings. It seems like the only way American workers can save, if it's institutionalized, and what you said at the beginning of the hour, it's kind of hidden from view. Automatic, untouchable account is the only way that Americans can save, and it turns out most people in the world as well.
Zvi Bodhi, I'll give you the last word in the last minute.
Well, I think we really have to do some fundamental rethinking about the whole idea of retirement and investment. I think that as we live longer, we're going to have to think about more than one career during a lifetime. And we're going to have to think about investing in continuing to maintain and develop new skills throughout our lifetime. And that's a radical rethinking of the way we live and the way we work.
Well, thanks to all the callers. Thanks to you. We've been talking with Edward Ferrigno, Vice President of Washington Affairs for the Profit-Sharing 401k Council of America. Thank you, Edward.
And you're quite welcome.
Sure. Zvi Bodhi, Professor of Finance and Economics at Boston University. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And from Notre Dame, Teresa Ghilarducci, Professor of Economics and Labor Economics.
Much.
I'm John Hockenberry, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.